I remember that around this time, 20 years ago, I was trying to form a grunge band in North Leeds, and we called ourselves Coma with a K. This gives you some indication about the musical quality of the output that we produced compared to kind of what was coming out of Seattle. And the other thing I'll mention, though, is that Soundgarden were on Jules Holland recently, so people who worry about how they've aged, you've aged a lot better than Soundgarden have, I think probably due to lifestyle reasons. Okay, so what I'm going to really do is, give a maths talk, really, about where I see networks sitting in to a kind of modelling framework. And my idea is to start off with an individual... stochastic model. And now you could really worry about just how general you can get with an individual-based framework, but I think as long as you start with the individuals, you're all right. So there's n of them. And I thought just about the most general population-level framework you'd really sensibly want to think about is one in which there's a random variable, aij, at time, and this is the rate I receives an infectious dose from J. So this is probably somehow slightly unsatisfactory as a definition in the starting point, but I really couldn't do much better than that. But the issue is that somehow, if you think about this, this is giving you a measure on the reals and a very high dimensional set of the reals. So the measure for this sort of thing. So this might include time-varying contacts, different intensity of contacts, asymmetry between individuals, different susceptibilities and transmissibilities. And the measure of all of that is over the positive reals and if you think individuals don't interact with themselves, but there's some asymmetry plus time. Anyway, it's huge, right? So the dimensionality of this system is just absolutely impossibly big. And so just to cash that out a bit more without loss of generality, despite that, you can always write so to give an idea about all the kind of things that you might try and pull into this, you might have a kind of susceptibility of I, this is mixing, and this is the infectivity of J. Okay. And so I think this is kind of conceptually what is going on in most people's heads when they're thinking about formulating a model. So you might think, well, you kind of want to get the fact that after you've got the infectious dose, you kind of start off not shedding very much, then you shed for a bit and that goes down. Or you might neglect that and just say, well, actually, you start off at infectivity one and you're held in that class of infectivity one for a fixed random period of time or a fixed period of time. Or these are the kind of things that are going on during model formulation. So I thought what I want to do is give the kind of simplistic, in a sense, the simplest kind of non-trivial example of what of how you kind of go from this to the models that were widely used during the flu pandemic. So the first thing you might make is a compartmental assumption. So during the flu, this was generally assumed two latent and two infectious classes. SIR. So as I said, I'd give examples from the 2009 pandemic. This was another sort of typical choice. And then you'd let your infectivity go like some kind of constant, perhaps, times the indicator functions. These indicator functions just take the value 1 if the expression in brackets is true and 0 otherwise. So your infectivity just depends on whether you're in the infectious class, right? And so then what people would do at age stratify So you have a class of ages, and each individual is allocated an age. So let's call that set of ages A. And in this case, you want M to be much less than N. So somehow in the order language of M, it's an order one quantity that doesn't grow. So next thing I'm going to do is say, well, M's going to be order N, and we'll get household models out. Then you'd say sigma I is a function just of that integer age A times whether you're susceptible or not. So the idea is that this is already a lot simpler because you've just got you've only kind of got a number of these susceptibilities to estimate according to.
Can you pull down the computer?
Oh yeah. Okay, so because of this assumption about the M, you then kind of know that the expected value of anything like this, so that this is all kind of heuristic, right? You can tighten this up if you're one of Peter's type 1 people who doesn't like this kind of argumentation. But somehow you kind of know that the occupation of each of these classes is going to grow like the system size. And so what this all ends up leading to is a set of differential equations . Okay, and you know that these corrections are going to go like the square root of M. So these things are all like going like N, these are going like the square root of M. So you can kind of neglect these if your population is big enough. But I think often the UK perhaps isn't big enough to neglect these, right? So I think the UK is big enough to neglect the order 1 over M, but perhaps not the diffusion. And I certainly know there's people here done very nice work on thinking about these terms. Okay, so what the problem this poses, even this lumping, right? So even you've had a very crude lumping of the model, throwing away loads and loads of potential structure that we know is really well biologically motivated. This isn't just kind of doing these type of pedantic things. We kind of know that people follow non-trivial shedding curves for flu and they're individually heterogeneous and so on. So after throwing away loads of biological realism, you still end up in a really fundamental problem in the field, which is that you can get vector stratified incidence data, but you've got a matrix here. So this is kind of the main thing I want to say. If I've got an overview where we are with contact networks, it's always this problem of dimensionality. And I would say there's kind of perhaps the most important thing that's happened in recent years is empirical work measuring these. Right. So the Polymod study, perhaps most conspicuously, did attempt to measure these, but I would argue that just moves the problem on. So it's moved us on an enormous amount. But the issue is you still don't know exactly how transmission scales with contact. So what people then do is they make simplifying assumptions that transmission scales with contact in a vector way. But in practice, all you're really doing is saying, well, we assume that transmission is a bit like contact or a bit simplifiable, but you've still got an issue of how transmission scales. How does the actual infectivity go conditioned on contact happening? Does it scale with the amount of time you spend with someone? Does that time saturate? All these things are kind of unknown. So we're a level of understanding advanced, but I think it doesn't, in terms of mathematical challenges, we can't kind of pack up and go home. We've still got to think about that problem of dimensionality. Okay. So networks. Topology that's best studied that I think really does deserve to be called. So I don't think this is kind of really a network model because you've thrown away a lot of the kind of repeated nature of the links. You assume that you're mixing with a kind of large pool of people. But I think household models are kind of the best understood network framework because you make proper repeated clustered contacts with the people in your household in the model, and you've not thrown away that repeated structure and that social structure. And the only real difference is that you kind of put formally, I mean, you wouldn't probably write A, you'd write H, but formally you do exactly the same thing as you do to get these. You just let the number of groups grow like the population size. So there's a large number of small households rather than a small number of large age classes, and the dynamics end up looking so, because Lorenzo showed you the other way of writing it, you end up with a kind of a correction to the SIR dynamics that relates to within household transmission. And to work at, to kind of keep track of this requires some quite large set of ODEs. But all you're really doing is just correcting for the fact that individuals also experience a limited force of infection from within the household. And that's based on repeated contacts. And this can be done for SIS, SIR. You know, there's a ridiculous amount that can be done for households. So I think they're a very good starting point. And I guess came out of the meeting of 20 years ago. And what's happened, again, perhaps more recently, and probably on the same timescale to this kind of revolution with measurement of contact patterns, is thinking about what you can do with random graphs other than the Erdős-Rényi graph. So I guess arguably it goes back to this work by Ludwig in the 70s, or people had always kind of known that epidemics were a bit like, or kind of homogeneous epidemics were under certain circumstances a bit like random graphs, really random graphs. I guess what's changed is people now do a lot more, right, a lot more kinds of random graphs. So I guess this is in the random graph literature, these households are what are called modular, or they're both households and age structured are a limit of what network theorists call modular networks. And so that's one. Well, those are two examples where you make contact with some of the Erdős-Rényi. But I guess things like the configuration model graph, and the reason this works, and I think the kind of fundamental insight is this paper, 2008, that if you look at what random graph theorists do now, the kind of ones that analyze what they call complex network models, they'll often define a stochastic process in which the, so you're mixing in the epidemic term, is actually given by the adjacency matrix of a random graph, and each element is just 0 or 1. So you've got a presence or absence of links. And what network theorists will often do, so Bolabash and these kind of people who apply probabilistic methods to random graphs, is they'll think about how you might generate this. So your Gij equals 0 might... So you might create links in a dynamical way on a population, the way that they kind of prove things and think about these structures. And that might happen at a rate... that's equal to some product of rates that are given to the individuals. So these might be discrete things that you count down in the case of the configuration model, or there's kind of variations where you give people a rate that stays fixed, and that kind of does a Poisson compounding on that. There's a nice review of lots of different methods of this by Tom Britton and others. And the basic idea is that in this paper you can compound the epidemic process with this process of making links. So for an SIR epidemic, because your epidemic process is a Poisson-like process, and this process of generating the complex random graph dynamically is a Poisson-like process, you compound those two. So you compound the epidemic and the random graph. And that's why we're able to know that a quite large set of ODEs, of ODE models are exact limits, in some sense, some appropriate meaning of the word exact and so on. And I guess really that, as it turns out, almost all of them are special cases of, so Eames and Keeling wrote down a very, very general, perhaps slightly too high dimensional for a lot of practical purposes, set of ODEs for heterogeneous random graphs. And it turns out that almost everything is kind of a special case of this, this set of ODEs, which turn out to be kind of exact. And I guess exact is the sense in which the corrections are going to be go like square root of m. So more general networks, though, and I guess the kind of note of caution I'd like to sound is that really most random graphical models are an awful long way from the observed population structure. So kind of the configuration model is such a beautiful generalization of the Erdős-Rényi, it's very tempting to think that this really tells you what's going on with heterogeneity, but it's a long, long way from any kind of observation. Yeah, the clustering coefficient, for example, is far too low. But even the degree-degree correlations aren't quite right. It's static. There's all kinds of issues with that. So the things that we somehow really have almost no analytic traction on, and also more general dynamics. So SIS type, so you can't do this compounding trick for SIS type dynamics. That was what Peter was mentioning. SIRS is kind of the same class of problem. So if you return to the susceptible state, you can't do these tricks. So general clustering and the other issue is, I guess, a slight generalization of this idea of space as long, shortest path length. So there are things other than lattices that exhibit long shortest paths. So if the shortest path is somehow growing a bit worse than log n. So I guess somehow slightly randomized spatial models, but where you've still got these long shortest path lengths, somehow that... I think these are all the sort of things that Peter identified as being real problems, right? And to give an idea of what I mean by general clustering, which is perhaps the one that wasn't covered, Lorenzo kind of alluded to. So a lot of the models that you can solve with some clustering, you have to kind of impose something like the triangles don't overlap with each other, or all of the clustering happens within cliques or within some kind of local structure. But pop quiz and... Okay, so you have a clustering coefficient C, that's the proportion of triples that are closed into triangles. So roughly speaking, it's these over, if you were to just count on the graph, it's these over, the triangles over the triangles plus the lines. So it's got to be between 0 and 1. And you've got the size of the giant component, that's between 0 and 1. And suppose you're on a three regular graph. And you increase the number, you increase the clustering coefficient in a general way, right? In a way that's representative of graphs with that particular clustering. So it's, I can tell you that you start there, right? This is in Balabash's book, you start there. In the large system limit. I'm going to give people three options for where this monotone decreasing curve intercepts. You're allowed to say don't know. So show of hands, right? Interactive as well as. So who thinks the transition due to clustering is at 1? This is what moment closure predicts, by the way. Who thinks it's at 2? 3? Who thinks it's there? Don't know. Go on, you'd be so cross if your students wouldn't even put their hands up. Goodness me, what a bunch of hypocrites. I wouldn't put my hand up probably either. Anyway, I'll tell you at the end.
Increasing the clustering, but are you only increasing clustering, or are you throwing away other edges so that the average number of edges is the same?
So it's k regular. So what the precise statement of it is, if you make a combinatorially exact sample of networks that are three regular but have a given clustering coefficient, so if you sample them according to their weighting in discrete structures up to isomorphism that are constructed in that way. At some point, you do break bits off the giant. So you break bits off the giant, and do you break them off so fast that you... At what point does that completely disconnect the network? Is it a clustering of a half, three quarters, or one? And I think, I mean, so I just, like I said, I've just submitted something on this. Right? And I think it isn't quite known. Okay, so... Why we kind of care is optimization. So I think I'll give three examples that are, I think, really kind of cast iron examples where network structure lets us do some optimization. So equalizing households, I think that's, again, going back to the 20 years, I think this is kind of not really been broken, and it isn't necessarily used by public health, right? Maybe it should be, but I think this is a real effect because it's been seen in, and I think if you interpret households more broadly as cliques, it's been seen in the kind of re-emergence of measles, right? The fact that you have big pools of susceptibles in these local cliques, I think is what's driven a lot of the, you know, these kind of non-vaccinating communities and so on. So I think this is a real optimising idea that you don't want to leave big clumps of susceptibility around. So I guess getting the tail in a power law network. So again, I think whether these networks are power law or not, somehow the idea that for perhaps sexually transmitted diseases or other things with a kind of enormous tail to contact behaviour, there's no point getting the kind of, you know, there's no point worrying about your maiden aunt's STI status. You want to get the people who are engaging in lots and lots of risky behaviour. And the other one is schools in the pandemic. And I think this is a nice example of where the network structure is really important, and this kind of heterogeneity. And I think it's related to the idea that we ought to be able to quantify our uncertainty in these ideas. So our R0 for the flu pandemic was, I think, pretty quickly established to be about 1.4. And people were pretty confident in this pretty early on. But if you think kind of heuristically or whatever, that this is kind of split up with that from a household bit. So the kind of big simulations almost all do something like this. So you have a household bit, a school workplace bit, something like this is dominated by kids, maybe. So there's a household bit, a school bit, and something else. And your confidence in how this R0 splits up, I think, is extremely low. Exactly how it goes, I mean, a third, a third, a third seems to fit pretty well, a third plus or minus bits. But I'd say our level of confidence in how this R0 divides between these, because if it's about a third of each, then it's very critical whether this school one is above 0.4 or not. Right? Do you remove 0.4 of the cases by shutting the schools? Because if you don't, then you've not controlled the epidemic. So we're actually quite near to control. And the reason that networks kind of, they have both this promise and this kind of technical difficulty is, well, what about, say, siblings sharing a school, right? So you get two siblings, they're both at the same school, they're both in the same household. So this makes it very hard to quantify exactly how these mix up. But also schools can tend to have geographical catchments. So in the big spatial models of the pandemic, these kind of other mixing is normally a kind of community, type thing that's geographically local. And so it's kind of correlated with where people go to school. So if you've got a spatial element to your model, like a purely spatial element, that's probably very strongly correlated with the school. So splitting up these things and working out how you can optimize your intervention is kind of really tricky. So so I was supposed to look at the past, but I think that something I hope will stimulate some debate, if I say it. So a lot of the talks are going, well, can we include additional heterogeneity? Can we include pathogen heterogeneity, host heterogeneity? Can we include this, that, or the other? Another vision for what we might try and achieve over 20 years is somehow here we've got the parameters of flu, and we get lots of signals about what the parameters of these are. So you might get GP, you might get GP type time series data. So I hope this ties, looks like it ties nicely with Simon's talk, actually. So you might get household-based studies like FluWatch, where you typically get kind of histograms over a season. I think it's quite hard to follow households in real time. So what you've really got is kind of final data. Then you might get really more detailed outbreaks. Some sort of data where you've got some attempt at the transmission tree from the public health system. And also there's sort of relevant parameters, things like polymod. And so another vision would be, can we make epidemiology into a precision science, right? So what you normally do is you pick your model for one of these sets of data and say, well, it kind of fits, right? And so we do the policy modeling and so on, but you've not really tried to cross-validate the parameters in that. Each parameter normally has a unique data source. But really, we think all these represent some underlying biological and epidemiological reality. And I'd say this is another 20-year challenge. It's as big as trying to include all these genetics and so on, is make real precision measurements of models from the 80s and 90s. Can we really tie down how likely I am to give you flu if I get within a metre of you? So we can measure now how likely I am to get within a metre of someone of a certain age and how likely those people are to know each other and all these other things that come from measurement of contact patterns. That gives us some prior information that might help with this task. You know, do you really know how that relates to transmission and the actual precise things that might let us kind of really optimize public health response? Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for a nice presentation of sort of the way we've been thinking pre-1993, but I think in the modern, in 2013, we ought to be thinking, instead of your AIJ function, about the fate and transport of a pathogen as it leaves one individual and goes through the environment, through the air or through surfaces, and reaches another individual. I mean, if we're going to scale anything in ways that are meaningful so that we can get data and really show. Now, I think that the Polymod provides one type of information, but each of the different pathogens have different fate and transport as they come out of one individual and go to another individual. And within individuals, you have variation in the number of pathogens that come out. And for the individuals who are receiving the pathogens, you have a total dose that reaches them and the time over which it reaches them. And these are the things that are really determining the scale. And we're starting to do science in that area. So it'd be good if the modeling, you know, caught up to that science in that area.
I completely agree. I should have had them shedding actually as well. Because I think that's key. Absolutely, you know, these kind of detailed mechanistic, like the veterinary talk, right? Yeah. With these actually mechanistic understanding, because that's the reality, isn't it? Is the actual pathogen is there in space doing something.
Not only is now, in the last couple of years, are we getting good data on the shedding, finally, but we're getting good data on how much reaches the fingers, how much transfers from the fingers to porous surfaces, how much transfers to smooth surfaces, how long they survive, what the death rates are on these different surfaces, and after you touch them, what the pickup rates are, and what the chances of getting to these. So we have, the science is increasingly looking at that detail, and that's what's really creating the network, and so we really should be thinking about using and modeling that kind of data rather than just modeling an arbitrary content.
I have two questions, short probably. So what you're talking about here is Markov epidemic. Everything is defined in terms of rates.
I guess it's Markovian transmission in the really general one, but I very quickly went to other things being Markov. But that very general thing I wrote down, no, it's supposed to be just that's why the dimensionality is so big. You've got to keep track of a measure over time as well.
Well, and, it can be inhomogeneous, but the AIT is non-random.
It's supposed to be a random variable. Yeah. In the most general case, you can...
Okay.
Because you might think about that lambda being some set of curves that you... Because that's what actually happens in the shedding data, right? Okay. What you'd really like to be able to represent is a probability of following a different curve, because that's what we observe. And to my knowledge, very few applied models do this, but it can be done for SIR as well, right, in households and on certain.
And the second thing is you consider the configuration type models. I didn't really get the rate KI, KJ, but related to that, have you thought of looking at Poissonian random graphs or inhomogeneous random graphs as Bolovac-Janssen and Riordan?
I only just recently read this review by of the random graph models in stuff. And I thought, yeah, these heterogeneous ones might, I think, epidemiologically, perhaps a lot more attractive than the configuration model. Actually, so that's instead of giving, so the configuration model, you give people a degree and you somehow constrain it, that people are going to have 10 contacts. But in these other ones, you give people a rate, and you say that's the rate at which they make contacts. Those rates are themselves heterogeneous. I think that's a lot more realistic, and we might be able to measure those rates, because you could ask, yeah, that you could put those rates into a GLM or something to apply to real data. So I think that's a very attractive modeling approach.
I don't know whether it's more realistic. Yeah. It's definitely, I think you get a lot of more free machinery to work with it.
Okay, I think we're going to have to leave it there. Thanks very much, Thomas, again.